First of all, thank you, Rabbi Kroll. Happy birthday, Rabbi Brody. And a very big yasher kovach to all of you, the parents of Katz Yeshiva High School, who took today, a day you could be off, relaxing, resting, vacationing, and the message you communicate, not only to your children, but to our community, a community of learners, is that the way a Jew vacations is by growing. It's by taking advantage of the opportunity to be together, to learn together, to be a community of learners. So a big yasher kovach to you, and I'm so grateful for this opportunity to address you, to speak to you this morning. There was a noted French naturalist, whose name I will probably butcher, but Jean-Henri Fabre. And he studied caterpillars. He came across what became a famous experiment about caterpillars. He noticed that caterpillars have a very special instinct to follow in lockstep with the caterpillar directly in front of it. They walk in a single file line. They stay right with the one that's right in front of it. And he decided he was going to test his observation by doing an experiment. So he took a flower pot, and he placed a number of caterpillars in a single file around the circumference of the rim of the pot. And each caterpillar's head touched the tail of the caterpillar immediately in front of it. And he then placed the caterpillar's favorite food in the middle of the circle. So the caterpillars are on the rim of the pot, lined up one right behind another, and there's food at the center of the pot. And he simply observed. He watched what would happen. And what he found was each caterpillar followed the one ahead of it, thinking that the one ahead of it knew how to get to the food. So the caterpillar on its own never analyzed the situation and never drew the conclusion that the food is in the middle, it's inaccessible. The caterpillar simply stuck with and continued to mindlessly and blindly follow the caterpillar right in front of it. Now what he did is somewhat cruel. I don't know if it would pass the PETA test here in America. But he decided that he wasn't going to interrupt. He was just going to continue to watch these caterpillars. And they kept moving around in circles for an hour. And the hour turned into a day. And after a few days of mindless motion, the caterpillar started to drop dead one after another. And he noted that all they had to do to avoid death was stop moving, break off of the chain, be mindful, think, draw their own conclusion about what to do. But because they had suspended their own thinking, because they were so mindless, so blind, simply being carried by the momentum of life, following everyone else and what everyone else was doing, it cost the caterpillars their life. And when we hear that experiment, aside from thinking maybe it was cruel to the caterpillars, but we think those are stupid caterpillars. Caterpillars are undeveloped, they're immature, their minds, their cognition. Those are stupid caterpillars. But the truth is, so many of us in our lives are as dumb and mindless and foolish and blindly following the person in front of us as those caterpillars. And while it might not cost us our literal lives, it's costing us our emotional lives. And it's costing us our spiritual lives. And it's robbing us of the meaning and the purpose and the tranquility that we crave and that we're capable of having. There is constantly noise in our lives. There's constantly something playing or beeping or buzzing or vibrating. There's constantly something to follow or like. There's constantly something to do or watch. There's constantly something we live in fear of missing out on. And that means that our lives are forever filled with noise and activity and busyness. We have no margin, we have no freedom, we have no space to think and to be and to analyze and to exist and to experience what life has to offer. And it's costing us our lives. It's costing us our lives. We live in a world that has more technological progress than ever, more comfort and ease than ever, more instruments and opportunities and devices. From the laundry machine to the dishwasher, to Waze, to Siri, to Alexa, to everything, we just speak and it happens and it does. And yet, you'd think if we measured happiness, it would be at an all-time high. If we measured mental health, it would be at an all-time high, and the exact opposite is true. Relationships are crumbling and dissolving. Mental illness is proliferating and rising. Anxiety, worry, depression, clinical and just otherwise. And it's because we have no menuchas ha-nefesh. We have no space. We have no margin. We have no ability to think. Our minds and our lives are cluttered and we're mindlessly following whatever marketing or pop culture or our friends or the fashion industry or what's in or in vogue is telling us to do. Like the caterpillars, we're on the rim of life, neglecting the food, the nourishment, what could sustain us in the blindless pursuit of keeping up with who is in front of us. Just mindlessly living life and forfeiting so much in the process. And that's what I want to talk to you about in our limited time today, because it's a relevant subject any day, but particularly this week, and particularly this parsha, it's relevant. And I want to share an insight. Slonim Rebbe quotes from the Chernobyl Rebbe, Rabbi Nachum Nochem of Chernobyl. Before Chernobyl was famous for its nuclear light, it was producing another light, the light of Chassidus, the Chernobyl dynasty. Every Twersky descends from the Chernobyl dynasty. So Rabbi Nachum Nochem, the Moorei Naim, he writes, Golos Mitzrayim, he midas hadas haya begolos. Golos and Geula are geographic descriptions. They're physical descriptions. There's a notion of being outside of Israel versus inside of Israel. That's Golos and Geula. But there can be Golos even in Israel, and we know that because the Torah tells us there were four stages of the development of the world, Tov, Avo, and so on. And one of those is a description of Golos Yavan. In Golos Yavan, we just finished Hanukkah. The exile, the Sikh, Syrian Greek oppression, the exile of the Syrian Greeks happened where? In Israel. And it's described as Golos, which tells us, as Zionistic as we are, as much as we long, and every one of us should be thinking about and struggling with our Aliyah, but never make the mistake of thinking it's a panacea, it's the result, it's utopia, it is Geula on its own. Without Hashras HaShchina, without the Beis HaMikdash, there's Golos even in the boundaries and the borders of Israel. It's a component of Geula, of redemption. But Golos and Geula are not geographic descriptions. And for the Chernobyl Rebbe, they're not physical descriptions of being in a state of persecution and oppression versus having liberty and freedom. A person can be persecuted and oppressed. The great Dr. Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, taught us that one can be in a Nazi death camp and have the humanity robbed from them or attempted to. One can be under the threat of extermination and annihilation. But when we transcend and choose our own identity and find meaning, we can't necessarily impact the conditions in which we live. But when we impact our response to it, that's freedom, even within persecution. Soviet dissidents, refuseniks taught us, even in Siberia, Natan Sharansky, others, through their attitude, you can have freedom even when you're enslaved. And you can be enslaved even when you are free. People who are addicted to technology and addicted to their grande, latte, caramel, swirl, whatever. Leave aside the kashrus of it these days, but we're free to choose. Should I go to the Starbucks near the Turnpike, or the Starbucks near the Circle, or the Starbucks further down on Glades? We're freedom. We have the mobility to physically choose which Starbucks I will be enslaved by their app and by their drink, where I pay a premium and markup that's beyond any mindful person never would. So one can have physical freedom without being persecuted and oppressed and be totally enslaved to technology, to Fortnite, to Starbucks, whatever your vice is. And one can be physically persecuted and oppressed, enslaved, and have the taste of incredible freedom. It says the Chernobyl Rebbe, these parshios are relevant to us. The book of Shmos we begin this week because thank God we live in this freedom of a country that's given us greater freedom than any other. The freedom we have, the freedom we have to practice religion. So on the one hand, we're freer than we've ever been. On the other hand, according to this definition, that histalkus hadas, that forfeiting our capacity to think, is galus. You know what exile is? When your mind, when your brain is in exile. Those caterpillars were in exile. And when we mindlessly live life, we are in exile. We watch what everyone else is watching and wear what everyone else is wearing. And we just do what everyone else is doing. And we're never fully present. We're never in the moment. Then we are in a state of exile. And when we're able to conquer it, and we're able to be disciplined over it, and we're able to be mindful in life, to think, to simply stop and think, that's redemption. That's redemption, and that's personal redemption. And so, the key to even being alive is to be thoughtful, is to be thinking, is to be mindful, is to be present in what we're doing. It's not just ignoble or unrighteous things that distract us from living a meaningful life. It can even be the most noble. When Moshe Rabbeinu ascends Har Sinai to go receive the Torah, Hashem says, Alei Elai Hahara Veheyesham, come up on the mountain and be there. Rashi's bothered other commentators. Why does Hashem say, be there? If he's on top of the mountain, where else is he? Alei Elai Hahara, be on top of the mountain, he's there. Why does God have to throw in Veheyesham and be there? Commentators already centuries ago pointed out, even before we walked around with this leash of our phone, or now we have a Bluetooth leash of our headphones or phone. What Hashem was telling Moshe is very simple. You know, I know on the base of that mountain, there's 2 to 3 million people, and they have very real and legitimate needs. They want your attention. They have questions to ask. They need your inspired leadership. I know that you have really important things to do. But when you're on top of this mountain, Heyesham, be with me. Put your phone off. Set them aside. Be present. Be mindful. Be with me. Because we are wherever our mind is. The Ramban writes, a person exists wherever their thoughts are. That's where we are. You finished your Shemona Esrei and you put a check because you think you finished Shemona Esrei, but you don't remember saying one word. You close the Siddur, you give it a kiss, and you close the Siddur. If you look in our, we just replaced our Siddur, but some of the old ones you find in Aleinu of Musaf, a lot of lipstick marks in the old Siddur. You give it a kiss from the women's section. You give it a kiss and you close the Siddur and you say, one second, I've been here for the last hour and a half, whatever, however long, half hour, hour, 2 hours on Shabbos morning. I don't remember saying one word. I don't remember saying one word. But I get a check, right? Because I said the Siddur. So the Ramban says we are wherever our mind is, not where our body is. Sociologists today have an expression they coined. It's called absent presence. Absent presence is when you're physically present, but you're absent even while you're present. It used to be called daydreaming. But now it's absent presence because it's worth. If you go to a park and you see parents who are pushing kids on the swing, and they come home, those fathers, and they tell their wives, I spent the afternoon with the children, I deserve a trophy, an award, I'm the father of the year, I spent the whole afternoon with the kids on the playground. Yeah, but if you're looking at your phone, responding to texts, watching, listening, reading, while on the other hand you're pushing, you are absent present. Your body might have been in the park with the kids, but the Ramban says you are wherever your mind is. You don't get credit, that doesn't count. Go to a restaurant and watch families who are supposedly out for dinner, see a couple who are on date night, and each one has their device on the other side of the table, and they're not texting one another. They just can't disconnect or turn it off. It's absent presence. When we stand in Davin and we put a check because I took my 3 steps and I bowed in the right spots, but I don't remember saying one word. It's absent presence. Hashem calls out to us like he did Moshe, and he says, hey, Yesham, whatever you're going to be doing that. Be in that moment. A chassid of Rav Moshe Kobruner once visited the Kotzker Rebbe. And different great chassidish rebbes were known for different virtues, different attributes, different greatness. So ask this chassid of the Kotzker Rebbe, what's your Rebbe great at? Giving staka, davening, chesed, learning, psak halacha. What's your Rebbe's greatness? Humility. So the chassid of the Kotzker Rebbe looked at him and said, my Rebbe's greatness is whatever he's doing at that moment. His greatness is being in that moment. That's our mission. If we feel we're in exile, if we're worried, if we're stressed, if we're anxious, if we're fearful, if we are envious, if we're quick to anger, the solution to it all is to be mindful, is to be present, is to be in control of what's happening in our lives, in control of our fears, in control of our feelings. Mark Twain once said a great quote. He said, I've known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened. I've known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened. We have such anxiety about what will be and what's going to happen and how will it turn out and how will it work and will I come through and what will other people do, because we're forfeiting our present by being in the future. We're either stuck in the past, nostalgic about what was, or we're anxious about the future, and in the process we forfeit the present. And the present is the biggest gift. It's why it's called the present. In fact, it's the only dimension that counts. It's the only dimension that matters. I'll tell you an amazing Gemara. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says, Rabbi Yitzchak says, "Ein danan zodam elafim masav shalosa shal." We usually think, I know it's December, not Elul time. We usually think that judgment, Hashem judges us based on the past. Whenever we're doing tshuva, whatever time that we're going to be doing tshuva, we're doing tshuva, we usually think having to do with the past. Jewish notion of tshuva is very different than the secular notion. I'm going to write an article this week about LeBron James's lame apology and why it is the perfect example of a bad apology. A Jewish apology, Jewish tshuva, is very different. So we usually think tshuva is about the past, right? Hashem judges us by my past. I have to be accountable for my past. Comes along the Gemara, Rabbi Yitzchak, and he says, no, tshuva has nothing to do with the past. God doesn't care about your past. And God doesn't care about your future. You know why? You can't control your past. You can't get back there. And you're not yet up to your future. You're not there yet. There's only one dimension you can live in. There's only one dimension you control. And there's therefore only one dimension that you're responsible or accountable for. And that is the dimension of the present. This very moment. Now, what you did in the past matters if it continues to inform and influence and shape your present. And the future matters if it inspires the choices you'll make in the present. So it's not that the past and the future don't matter. They matter, but they only matter to the degree that they contribute to the present. Because the only dimension that counts and for which we are held accountable is right now. And I'm going to prove it to you with an incredible Gemara in Kedushin. The Gemara says, a person says, Hareyat Mekudeshesli. Behold, you are betrothed to me. I proposed, I want to be married to you. Amanas Shani Tzadik. On a condition that I'm righteous. Now you can propose, you can be married on a condition. And if the condition is fulfilled, you're married. And if the condition is not fulfilled, you're not legally married. It's not binding. So let's say I propose on the condition, I'm a tzaddik. I'm a tzaddik. Is it binding? Well, if I'm a tzaddik, it makes sense that it's binding. Now let's say on the way to the proposal, I got hungry when I was picking up the ring, so I stopped for a cheeseburger at Burger King. And 10 other examples of chatam, I spoke terrible Lashon Hara and I cheated on my taxes. I paid him cash at Burger King so I wouldn't have to pay taxes. Come up with 100 aveiros ben adal makom ben adal chavero on my way to propose on condition that I'm a tzaddik. And now it comes before a rabbi a question, is the marriage binding? This Eisvarf was eating a cheeseburger that's still dripping off his lips while he's proposing a reyat, says, Almanas shani tzaddik. Is it a good marriage? Is it binding? And the simple answer would be no. This guy's a tzaddik. This guy is the dictionary definition of a rasha. What do you mean, is it tzaddik? So the Gemara says it's binding. It's chal. Why? Shema hir her betshuva. Because at the moment he handed the ring and he said, Harei mekudeshesli, Almanas shani tzaddik. The moment he said, on condition I'm righteous, he had in mind to transform himself, to become a righteous person. In that expression, in that condition, he was saying his aspiration, his ambition. Oh, that cheeseburger? That wasn't me. That was the old me. That's not me anymore. His aspiration is to be a tzaddik. Okay, but still, can you become a tzaddik just by thinking I'm a tzaddik? Can you be a tzaddik and erase what you did on your way in the room to being a tzaddik? The Gemara says, yeah, absolutely. As long as right now you aspire to be a tzaddik, we treat you and we relate to you like you're a tzaddik. The only dimension that matters is the here and now. It's the only dimension we can be in. So to forfeit it with nostalgia for the past, or the planning, or the fear, or the anxiety, or the worry, or the envy of the future, is to lose out on the only part of our lives that we are in control of. And that is the present, the here and now. The father of the modern day mindful movement is Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn. And he developed this notion of mindfulness for stress reduction. Breathing deeply, meditating, being fully present in every morsel of food that you're chewing, in every conversation that you're having, in every decision that you're making, in everything that we're doing. Not blindlessly going through life, but being present. And he has a great quote. He says, now is always the right time because it's the only time. Now is always the right time because it's the only time. In Sefer Dvarim, Hashem says, V'yatah, Ma'ashem lakecha shol me'imach, Moshe quotes Hashem who says, V'yatah, and now, what does God want from you? And then he goes on to say this litany of things that Hashem wants from us, including Yiras Hashem. As if it's such a small thing. Gemara asks for Moshe, it's such a small thing. But the Chafetz Chaim reads it. You know what Hashem is asking from you? Viata. Be in the present. Be in the here and now. Stop dreaming about the future, planning for the future, lost in the future, worried about the future, anxious about the future. Stop living in the past, reflecting on the past. Be in the present. Now is always the right time. Viata. Because it is the only time. There are two Harvard professors, Matthew Killingsworth and Daniel Gilbert. They published a study in the journal Science, and they found, what percentage do you think that people are awake? What percentage of people's waking hours are they thinking about something other than what they're doing? So you're driving, but you're not thinking about driving. I lived in Captiva, then we moved to Thornhill Green, and I remember it was a week or two after we moved, and I was driving home. I had a legitimate reason to drive home from shul at the time. And I was driving home, and I was on the phone, and the next thing you know, I was in the driveway of the new owner of my old home's house, Captiva. And I laughed it off, right? Because what happened? My body, my hands on the steering wheel, my foot on the gas pedal, just took me to the place that I had been driving to every day. It was mindless. I was in the wrong place. I drove to the wrong place because I literally, and I had no memory of pulling out of my parking spot, pulling out of the shul, driving on Montoya Circle, we mindlessly. So that's an example, maybe an extreme one. What percentage do you think of our waking hours are we thinking about something other than what we're doing? Harvard researchers, a study in the magazine Science. What percentage? 46.9% of the time. 47%, we can round up. Half the time we're awake, that number is astounding. Half the time we're awake, we're thinking about something other than the thing that we're doing. And we wonder why our health is failing, our relationships are failing, our emotional health is failing. What are we thinking about? Half the time that we're doing something, we're davening, we're thinking about something else. Having a conversation, thinking about something else. Watching something, doing something, listening in class, but thinking about something else. What are we thinking about? We're thinking about, I'm missing out. I bet everyone else is having a great time. I really should have gone to the other place. What is everyone else up to? Why didn't I get invited? Thinking about, am I going to pass that test? What school am I going to get into? Where am I going to be able to go? What's going to happen with my grandmother, with my uncle, with my cousin? We're worried, we're anxious, we're envious, FOMO. We're forfeiting and we're compromising and we're conceding our present like mindless caterpillars who are chasing after one in front of another. And it's bringing our slow death, maybe not so slow. Torah says, Heyei Sham. Whatever you're doing, don't just be there 50% of the time that you're doing it. Give all of yourself. Be there the whole time. It's where we belong. And it's the secret to happiness. It's the secret to patience. It's the secret to emunah, to faith. It's the secret to good health. Scientists are also showing that our cardiovascular system is compromised, our pulmonary system is compromised, because we're not breathing as often and as deeply as we should. Any doctors here? They will confirm, I think. I'm an armchair amateur reader of this research, summaries. But the research shows that we are not breathing as deeply or as often, we're not bringing in as much oxygen as we should. And why is that? Why is that? So part of it shows because our head is not in the optimum position to breathe air. Most of the time our head is down. And why is our head down? Because we're looking at some device. We're texting or playing or reading or listening or watching with some device. We're not getting in as much air as we need to be breathing. We're racing, we're running, we're doing. When Moshe comes to Mitzrayim and he says to the Jews who are in their exile, they have no das, they have no mindfulness, they have no space, they have no margin, they have no capacity to think. And he says, Chevra, I have great news. We're out of here. 210 years of persecution and murder and suffering. And I have phenomenal news. A bright, brand new future, a new reality. It's going to be amazing. Gefilte fish and bagels and lox and all kinds of delicacies you're going to eat. Customs we're going to develop and a lifestyle we're going to have. And they look up and what do they say to him? Get lost. Can't you see we're busy here? We got work to do. Who hears a message of redemption, the oracle of a brighter future, and sends him packing on his way? So Torah tells us, you know why they didn't hear him? Mekotzer ruach me'avodah kasha. Kotzer ruach is shortness of breath, Rashi says. Kotzer ruach, shortness of breath. The Or HaChaim says, you know what kotzer ruach means? Ruach as in we've got ruach, yes we do. Ruach is, we've got enthusiasm, we've got spirit. The spirit was sucked out of them, it was killed from them. Where did it go? Paro made them incredibly busy. This week's parsha. When Paro senses a little breakthrough that maybe they think they can redeem themselves, there's going to be an insurrection, they're going to rise up and rebel. What does he do? He piles on the work. Piles on the work. He makes them incredibly busy. Busy. We live in a generation that suffers from the busyness trap. You know what the busyness trap is? We confuse busyness with productivity. We confuse being busy with being productive. But more than that, we think busyness is a commodity. We think busyness is impressive. We see one another, maybe more with adults. I don't know if this is true with teenagers. But you say, hey, what's going on? How are you doing? What are you up to? Oh, I'm busy. Crazy busy. Psycho busy. I'm insanely busy. I've never been busier. Busy. Why do we say that? What are we really saying? You should be really impressed with me because I'm so busy. I got a lot going on. I got a lot of responsibilities and a lot of things to do and a lot of places to be and a lot of people to see, and I'm busy. So I'm impressive. We fall into that busyness trap, and we confuse busyness with importance. Busy, busy, busy. We're always busy. That's not impressive. It's pathetic. Because our busyness often is not productive. It's just busy, and it means that we have no control. Our life is a runaway train. We're caterpillars following blindly on the rim of the flower pot. It means that we're never fully there. We're not 50% absent present. We're 80, 90, 100% absent present because we're busy, 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 busy. We're running and running, and we're always busy. And Paulo understands, you know what happens when a person's busy? They stop breathing. Running, running, running. You know what happens when you're busy? You eat junk food because you don't have time to plan a good meal. When you're busy, you don't have conversations or spend time with the people around you who supposedly matter most. And when you're busy, you don't have good judgment to make the decisions that are in your best interest. And when you're busy, you simply sacrifice and give up your life because you're running and running and running, and you're busy and you're busy and busy, and nobody is impressed but you. The real impressive people are the ones who say, I'm getting a lot done. I'm involved in these projects. I'm proud of this. And I found time for exercise and learning and meditation. My spouse and children, not in this order, and eating right, and all these other really virtuous, worthwhile, important things. That's impressive. Busyness is exile. And menuchas hanefesh, freedom to think and to be not absent present, but fully present. Not to be mindless, but mindful. That's geula, that's redemption. Not lost in the future, and not holding on to the past, but in the present. Now is the most important time because it's the only time. And so the Jewish people couldn't hear this message of hope and a brighter future. Why? Kotzer ruach. Running, running, running. So Paro says, oh, there's a glimpse. They have some aspiration. They have a vision of being able to be redeemed. I got to pile on more work. I got to make it more busy. Because Paro understood what our generation fails to understand. We live in this incredibly free society and free world, but we have taken too much busyness, so we've enslaved ourselves. Busy, busy, busy. I got 10 series on Netflix I have to keep up with. Do you know the responsibilities I have to follow 10 series, plus the playoffs, plus... You understand what I have to balance, how busy I am? So we have physical freedom. I can borrow this friend's Netflix account or sign into the other friend's Netflix account. We have the freedom of whose friend's Netflix account to steal. But we are totally enslaved to keeping up and to binge watching and to getting it all done and to being busy so much so, kotzer ruach, we're out of breath from the avodah kasha, from the labor that we've put upon ourselves. And you know what happens when you don't breathe? You're not alive. It's not a coincidence, the Mefarshim explain. The Hebrew word for breath is nishima. Does that sound like another word you know? Nishama. How did we first get our neshama? Where did it come from? God created the whole world with words. Baruch she'amar v'haya ha'olam. Basar ma'amaros nivra olam. God created the whole world. For many, many, many generations, no one knew what that meant. That was a leap of faith. Believing that God could, you could create something through speech, was as big as believing in the 10 plagues and the splitting of the sea. But our generation, we totally get it. Because you tell your Tesla, drive me to Katsushiva High School for the Yom Iyun, and then you start texting or watching those 10 series on Netflix, and next thing you know, you're in the parking lot. I don't know if it works that well, but maybe it will one day. Or you tell Alexa, what's the weather? Or Wemo, turn on the light. Or Waze, get me where I need to go. We have speech recognition, so we understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could speak. If we can speak and create, certainly Hashem could speak, and He created the whole world. Ours is the first generation to really appreciate speech recognition. But when He created us, when He created man, He didn't do it using the power of speech or speech recognition. He did it in a different way. Speech comes from a very shallow place. It comes from the lips and the voice box, the larynx. It comes from a very shallow place. But when God created us, where did He create us from? He took a deep breath and drew the breath from deep inside Himself, kiviyachol, and He blew it into us. Like a glass blower who expands the glass. Anyone here ever blow up a balloon for a birthday party or your younger sibling's birthday party? After you blow up a series of balloons, depending on whether you work out or not, you could be out of breath and exhausted. Right? Not just if you're terribly out of shape, but decently out of shape person, by blowing up balloons, is out of breath. Because you're breathing from deep inside yourself and inserting that into something else, expanding. You're sharing that breath. You're sharing your essence with something else. Hashem shared His essence with us, and He did it not superficially or shallowly through words, but He did it by drawing the breath from deep inside Himself and breathing it into us. And how do we reaffirm that that breath is still inside ourselves? How do we make contact with our neshama? We have this body, and the body has all kinds of needs and drives and temptations and desires and appetites. The body wants to eat some of the wrong things and look at some of the wrong things and go to some of the wrong places and inhale some of the wrong things and do some of the wrong things. And we have a soul inside that body who's trying to control that body and say, whoa, 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 you're not in charge. The animal instinct and the animal impulse and the animal drive? No, it's me, the soul, who's the driving this body. It's a struggle, it's a tension, it's a regular wrestling match, it's a battle that's waged all the time. So you know what energizes or empowers the soul to win? Deep breathing. The neshima is how we access, it's how we nourish, it's how we nurture the neshama. Through deep breaths, we make contact with our neshama. We restore it. We give it life. We're able to create calm. People who are having a panic attack are taught deep breathing. Lamaz, if you're experiencing intense pain, deep breathing to endure. Somebody who needs to make an important decision, breathe deeply. Trying to fall asleep, breathe deeply. How do we get to that place of calm? How do we get to the place where our neshama is back in control? We're not a body who has a soul, but we're a soul that has a body. It's through that deep breathing. It's that mindfulness. It's taking a few moments and disconnecting and breathing deep, giving our soul back its life, its nourishment. Our neshama thrives through a deep neshima, through some deep breathing. If I weren't out of time right now, we'd practice some deep breathing just to give a taste and a sense of the calm it brings and the hope it brings and the sense of mindfulness, the presence, the intentionality that we're capable of getting through the neshama. The two instruments that are similar but very different, a thermometer and a thermostat. A thermometer tells you the temperature. It can tell you, is it hot, is it cold, what's the temperature? The thermometer tells you the temperature. But the thermostat allows you to adjust it. You see the temperature, but you could adjust it. And the question in our lives, and I wish we had much more time to develop it, but the question in our lives is, are we a thermometer or a thermostat? Do you just have the self-awareness to know how you feel? I'm angry, I'm tired, I'm jealous, I'm happy, I'm fulfilled, I'm sad, I'm disappointed. Are you just a thermometer? You can tell your own temperature, or are you a thermostat? Can you control it? Are you in control of it? Do you determine your feeling? And to be a thermostat is to be mindful. It's to live in the presence. But what I want to leave you with is the gift of knowing that while mindfulness is in the news today and is popular today, it has always been the core of what Judaism is all about, is the purpose and the essence of what we're doing and why we're here and what our mission is. Pasuk says in Kisavu, Shmartam is Dibra Abris Azos V'Asisimosam. Hashem says, keep my covenant, follow my mitzvahs, observe my laws. Why? What's the goal? What's the purpose? L'ma'an taskilu. Eskol asher ta'asun. What is that word, l'ma'an taskilu? Taskilu, maskilim, we use in a derogatory sense now to talk about the enlightenment, those who walk away from Judaism. But the Torah uses, and the prophets use the word taskilu, the maskilim, or the enlightened, in the positive sense. What does it mean to be enlightened? Says God, the Torah, living a Torah life makes you enlightened. What does it mean to be enlightened? Certainly it gives us a window into the truth. It gives us a window into what's just, what's right, what's moral. God created us. Certainly He knows the programs He put inside of us and gave us the manual about how to get the most out of our lives. But it means something even more. The Ibn Ezra and the Targum Yerushalmi say, L'man taskilu means L'man tatzlichu. Man tatzlichu means that you be successful, says the Targum Yerushalmi, Yizbonanu. A contemplative life is a successful life, is a happy life, is a meaningful life. Why give us Divrei HaBris HaZos? Why do we have the whole Torah? It makes us mindful. It makes us contemplative. And just think about your life from the moment you woke up this morning. Were your first words were Moda Ani, an expression of gratitude? Which pant leg did you put on first? Which shoe did you tie first? Did you wash your hands the correct way? Did you say the brachas? When you had your cup of coffee, when you ate your breakfast, was it kosher? Did you be mindful to say a bracha beforehand? Everything from how we wake up until we go to sleep, and everything in between, every aspect of Torah, mitzvot, and halacha are a guide for how to live a mindful and meaningful life in which we are fully present in everything that we're doing. Be present in what comes in our mouth. Be present in what goes out of our mouth. Be present in what we do, where we go, what we say, what we listen to. Torah is a platform for mindfulness. But we've given it up. We've learned how to go through it by rote and in the motions and mitzvot and nashim in the muda. And we really are holding on to the treasure that the whole rest of the world is just discovering. But if we take deep breaths and we return and restore our neshama and we make that effort to be present in everything we're doing, leman taskilu, leman tatzlichu, the success, the happiness, can help overcome the anxiety and the worry and the fear about the future that's not yet here. All we have is the now and what we can do in the now. It can help us overcome the FOMO, because it doesn't matter where everyone else is. All I have is the Ata. All that matters is where I am, and all I'm mindful of is right now. We can overcome in the relationships by spending quality time. V'heyeh sham, to be fully present in everything we do and in everywhere we go. Christopher Reeve, who was Superman, played the character of Superman, led most of his life as a paraplegic because of a terrible equestrian accident. He was racing a horse, and his horse stumbled on one of the hurdles, thank you, and the horse fell on top of him and left him paralyzed for the rest of his life. And Christopher Reeve was once interviewed and asked, how did that happen? How did that go wrong? That was an accident, that was a mistake that changed his life forever. Superman became immobile. And he said, you know, it wasn't the hurdle that was the hardest one. I knew that in this race there was one hurdle that was particularly challenging and difficult, but that wasn't the one that my horse tripped on that landed on top of me and changed my life forever. You know which hurdle it was? It was the one before that. Because in the one before the most difficult one, I stopped thinking about the hurdle I was going over and I started to think about the next one. And when I stopped thinking about what I was doing right then and started thinking about the next one, when I took my mind off of the now and started thinking about the future, that's what allowed this accident to happen that changed his life. Superman's kryptonite was forfeiting the present. And it's our kryptonite too, unless we recover it. Unless we reclaim it, unless we take it back. Are you the pilot or are you the passenger in your life? Are you along for the ride or are you driving the plane or the car and dictating where it goes? The answer is, the geula, the redemption in our life comes when we're ready to reclaim it with a sense of mindfulness. Thank you very much.